I think I mentioned last time the general issue of clean up your own mess as a way, incentive for efficient behavior. And a particularly striking example occurred to me earlier today. And that is that one problem that universities not uncommonly have is the erasing of whiteboards. That a professor scribbles all over the whiteboard and then he hurries out on the next professor. Now, there is an obvious and elegant solution to this problem. And obviously, somebody in this university thought of it. It cannot be a coincidence that my two classes are in the same room, not quite in succession, but with only one class in between, with the result that if I leave the whiteboard covered with scribbling, I'm the one who's got to deal with it when I arrive. So that's clearly a decision made by somebody with a good eye to the economic incentives involved. I thought I would start with a very brief review of what we did last time. I will then spend as long as you want, answer any questions or discussion or whatever you have on the first two chapters. I will then go on to a roadmap to sketch out what we're going to be doing in the course of the course, and then get on to efficiency and stuff like that. That's basically what chapter two is about. So, to begin that process, as I explained, what you're supposed to be doing in terms of the course is a midterm, a final exam, and one brief, either written or oral piece, arguing one side of the case from an economic analysis of law point of view. As I explained, what economics is not the study of the economy, at least as I understand it, but rather a way of understanding behavior, which starts from the assumption that the best way of predicting behavior is to assume that individuals take the actions to achieve their objectives. And I mentioned the examples of rational babies and rational cats. I could have mentioned rational genes as well, because if you think about evolutionary biology, one way of looking at evolutionary biology is it's saying that genes are rational. That is, they control the organisms they build in such a way as to increase the number of copies of that gene in future generations. In fact, one sort of standard example where the evolutionary biologist and the economist are doing essentially the same analysis in a different field is a very simple puzzle that probably has not occurred to any of you. And that is, why is the number of girl babies and the number of boy babies about the same? It's empirically true for humans, for many other species, but not for all species. Why? If you don't see an obvious answer, don't feel too badly. The guy who solved this problem is a man by the name of Sir R.A. Fisher, who was simultaneously one of the world's leading geneticists and one of the world's leading statisticians. And I am told that it was at one time the custom at Cambridge University to take two copies of the London Times, which had a famously difficult crossword puzzle. And it was a competition, and one copy was for R.A. Fisher and the other was for the rest of the senior common room. Solution is, but it's an economist solution. Suppose it were the case that two-thirds of babies were girls. It seems in some sense efficient because, after all, males are really superfluous. That is to say, one male can provide children for many more than one female. But suppose that two-thirds of the children are females. Since every child has one father and one mother, that would mean that on average men were having twice as many children as women were. But if men are having twice as many children than women are, then a genetic tendency to produce male babies will result in your having more descendants than a genetic tendency to produce female babies. Does that make sense? More grandchildren. Therefore, following alpha logic, a tendency to have more boys will tend to increase in frequency in the population, and will keep doing so until you have roughly equal numbers of both. Isn't that neat? As an economic-style argument being used in evolutionary biology. Can you see where you would expect the prediction not to hold? What kind of species would you expect to have unequal gender ratios? Yeah? Why? True for humans, too.
only takes one man to impregnate many, many women. If it were the case that most chickens were female, then a tendency to produce roosters would mean that you had many more descendants than a tendency to produce hens. And thus, the tendency to produce roosters would increase the frequency in the population.
I don't know what happens with hermaphroditic species. The case I was thinking of was much simpler. Suppose you have a case where the cost to the parent of producing one gender is much higher than the other. For example, a species with large sexual dimorphism in which the males are much larger than the females. I think elephant seals are the example I've heard of for this. In that... Yeah, or it could be making more food. That would give the same kind of effect. But take the simplest case where the infant is twice as heavy, and therefore you think about a species that produces multiple infants. The choice is producing two boys or four girls. All right, in that case, if the gender ratio is 2-1, then if you produce girls, you have four girls, each of whom has half as many children as a boy. If you produce boys, you get two boys, same number of grandchildren each way. So, putting in the economic terms, this is a whole lot like saying that in markets, prices go to cost. Very much the same reason. So, anyway, but that's an example of rational behavior, as it were, that the genes determining whether you have male or female children act, as it were, rationally to maximize their chance of being passed to future generations. Anyway. The digression, but I think it's sort of a new one, so I'll tell you anyway. So, basic economic approach is individuals have objectives, they tend to choose the acts that best achieve. In principle, in applying this to the law, we ought to apply it to the enforcement side as well as the enforcee side. We ought to think about the objectives of police and prosecutors and judges as well as criminals and victims and such. We do sometimes, but not very often. And I recently read a book which has some interesting evidence on that, in the case of prosecutors, the DAs. It turns out that in New York, public prosecutors are elected. They're elected every 3 years. And somebody, for some other reason, provided a list of innocent people who had been convicted, I think of murder, I'm not sure, over a long period of time, 50 years or 100 years in New York State. And so someone looked at the question of what year they were convicted in. And it turned out that your chance of being convicted of a murder, I think it was murder, I'm not sure, that you hadn't committed, was higher in an election year. 1 year out of three. And in fact, if I remember correctly, it went up the month before the election and went down the month after the election. I think that's a correct statement. Well, in one sense, you would say, look, aren't these corrupt people? But a different way of putting it is, you know, how hard you push partly depends on the payoffs. And if you say, I want the news stories before the election to say that the guy who did that horrible murder has been convicted, thanks to the good efforts of Prosecutor Smith, that's careful about how it is. So I thought that was a nice example of seeing that you ought to apply the same principle across the board, not only on one side. What does economics have to do with law? The simplest answer is you can think of legal rules as a system of incentives, and you can then say, how will rational people respond? Given that you have these rules, what will people do? When will it pay you to have your brakes checked, given the rules of tort law? When will it pay a firm to investigate possible problems with its products, given liability law and disclosure law and so forth? And you can think of all sorts of other things of that sort. So the first level is you're using economics to predict the effect of legal rules. The second is that you might be able to use it to explain what the legal rules are. And there we've got the Posner conjecture as one big attempt to do that. And third, you might, if you think that certain economic outcomes are desirable, use economics to figure out what you wanted the law to be. All right, let me now stop for a break. And ask whether you have points that struck you either in class 2 days ago or in reading the first two chapters of my book that you would like to discuss.
All clear as pea soup? Or? Nobody? This is your chance. Pretty soon I start talking again. All right.
Let me then
briefly sketch the roadmap to the course.
There are, in my view, two different ways you can organize the course of economic analysis of law. One is by economics and one by law. So the one approach is to say, here is an economic principle, let's understand it. It's relevant to the law. Here are some other economic principles relevant to the law, so forth, so on, and so on. The alternative is to do it by the law, to say, here is property law. What does economics tell us about it? Here is tort law. What does economics tell us about it? Here is criminal law. What does economics tell us about it? And the way I decided to organize the book, because it was the way I had organized the course, the book came out of my teaching this course, was both. So what I do is that in the first half of the book, roughly, I'm running through the economics. I'm trying to take various ideas in economics, most of which apply across a lot of different areas of law, and explain them one by one. There is then a brief part of the middle, which you can probably skip, which is my not very expert summary of how American law legal system works, which you hopefully already know more about than I do anyway. And I then switch and start doing it in terms of the different kinds of different areas of the law. So the first half, we begin with what we're doing today, which is economic efficiency, which turns out to be an interesting and useful concept, and one which can be very loosely defined as the size of the pie, maximizing the size of the pie. And if you think about that for more than a couple of minutes, you will realize that it's not clear what that means, how we trade off. First, how we, for a single person, how we add up different sorts of benefits: the chance of dying in an auto accident, the chance of marrying the woman you love, the chance of being overweight, the chance of being able to eat Baskin-Robbins ice cream. There are all sorts of things that people value. How, for a single person, do you add them up to get a single number? And then, when you've got 300 million people, or 7 billion people, or whatever population you're looking at, how will you add up across the whole thing so as to get the equivalent of a single number for the size of the pie? So that's a non-trivial problem that we'll be dealing with today. Next chunk of it, starting I think next week, is externalities. Externalities are cases where my action imposes costs or benefits on other people and does not require their consent to do it. And we will be seeing two different approaches to looking at externalities. The traditional approach, which economists identify with the economists called the GOO, and then a new approach, where new means now about 50 years old, associated with a man called Coase. Coase, however, is still alive at age 100, I'm glad to say. Nice man. And we will be looking both at what externalities are, why they raise a problem for legal rules, what the various ways are of dealing with them, why the GOO's way makes much more sense than the earlier alternative, but why Coase demonstrates that there are serious problems with the GOO's approach. We will try to show how the theory of externalities could be used to design legal rules. There is a chapter which I associate with what I call the spaghetti diagram, in which you are imagining for a particular very small set of issues, here are the possible rules you might start with, here are the possible outcomes you might want to get from each rule, how would you get from this rule to that outcome. Using that diagram, if you knew how likely it was that the various outcomes would be the right outcome, how would you pick a rule? So it's an attempt at a very simplified level to show how, if you only knew enough, you could decide what the law would be. All right? And as you'll see, it takes a good deal of a chapter just to do that. And you can think about that. One way of thinking about it is the question, who has what rights and how are those rights defined? One of the issues we'll discuss, a fairly simple one, is the two different approaches that we refer to as property rules versus liability rules. Where a property rule is a rule saying, if I want to use your car, I have to have your permission. And if I use your car without your permission, terrible things will happen to me.
A liability rule says, if I want to use your car without your permission, that's fine. You'll just sue me for whatever damages I do as a result. And there are certain issues, such as my debting your car with my car, where we take it for granted the liability rule is the right approach. The property rule for that would say I can't pull out of my driveway until I have permission from everybody whose car I might dent thereafter. Whereas there are other areas, such as using cars, where we take it for granted the property rule is right. And we will hopefully be able to see some of the reasons why one of those categories of rule makes sense for some things and one for others. We will then go on to talk about the economics of risk. And the economics of risk can be usefully thought of in terms of the economics of insurance. But in fact, if you think about legal rules, a lot of them are about allocating risk. If you draw up a contract, for instance, one of the questions you have to think about in designing a contract is, if something goes wrong, who pays for it? If it turns out that Intel designing the new chip for Apple's new computer takes longer than Intel said it would, does Intel owe Apple money, or does Apple just swallow the loss? The real case, I think, was Motorola, not Intel, and that was one of the reasons why Macintoshes now use Intel chips. Motorola, which used to make the chips for the Macintosh, was unable to do the transition to a smaller chip size as rapidly as they expected. Anyway, but the general issue of allocating risks, if you think about when I drive the car, there is some risk that I will damage you or your car. How do we allocate that risk? When we convict people of crimes, there's some risk we'll get it wrong. How do we allocate that risk? And lots and lots of other questions. So if you think about it in terms of insurance and why people have insurance and what are the problems with having insurance, it's become a hot issue recently because of healthcare, but it's really been an interesting, important issue for a long time. It helps you think about the economics of risk and risk allocation. Why do people buy insurance? Why would you choose to buy insurance? You know that you're losing money on average, right? Unless the insurance company made a mistake. Because they got to pay their employees and their rent. In addition, as they take money from the customers, they send money out for customers, got any something left, or they go broke. So why do people engage in such a foolish transaction? Yep. Early on.
You should always save up the money over time. But
well, you wouldn't know how much to save if it's uncertain.
Right. So that's why they get insurance, because they don't want to take the money. Yep.
Well, people generally buy insurance, and I guess with the exception of automobile insurance, it's mandated. People generally buy insurance to guard against catastrophic events like bankruptcy.
Yeah, why do they do that? Why would you rather, given the opportunity to be sure of paying $1,000 a year instead of one chance in 100 of paying $100,000, why would you prefer the former?
Because it guarantees if that event occurs, all the better. I guess the alternative is, I'm not sure that you suggested, is, you know, sock away $100,000 at the end, you're not going to know.
Well, but presumably most of the insurance losses aren't going to bring you below zero, right? If your house burns down, your house burns down. You don't owe the mortgage after the house burns down. It's not clear below. It might bring you debt, but that's only 2-0. But if you think about the general case of why, even though you know that seen as a gamble, it's a losing gamble on average. In what sense is the gain? Why are you willing to? Right, we have a deal, and the deal is, on average, you will pay us $1,000, and we'll pay you $900. That doesn't sound like a good deal. Why is it? Yes. Maybe, on the other hand, you should gain some dissatisfaction from knowing that if it doesn't, you've just wasted your $1,000 a year. Yeah?
Well, that's going to take a certain, not even risk, but it allows you to perform basic life functions like go water skiing or buy a house or drive a car, assuming it wasn't mandated, that you maybe wouldn't be willing to perform otherwise.
Except that by not performing them, you wouldn't have to pay the $1,000 a year for insurance. Why is it that you regard $1,000 or $100 a year of insurance as a lower cost than a small probability of a large payment? People clearly do it. The question is, can we understand why they do it? Yep.
I mean, you could make the argument that they overestimate the likelihood of
things. We believe people are rational. In this class, we're in general, most of the time, we're going to assume people are rational. Maybe you're right, but I don't think you need to assume that. Yep?
Well, some of the money the insurance company makes is by investment. So if you're
but you could invest with the money, too.
Well, if you're assuming that they're such a good, great investor, that
yeah.
Company,
not very likely. So you could fire somebody else who's great investor. All right, well, why don't you think about it? We're going to come back to it. So I think there's a very straightforward answer, and the answer is important because it has to do with the fact that dollars aren't what really matters. Which will be a general subject that's worth thinking about in economics. The next thing we're going to do is a chapter that really comes out of an article I read a long time ago that struck me as making an interesting point, and that's the distinction between two approaches to enforcing rules, one of which we call ex ante and one of the next post. And in the context of the law, an ex ante rule might be a speed limit saying you can't drive faster than 70 because we think if you do, that imposes a risk of accidents. An ex post rule might be you can drive as fast as you like, but if you cause an accident, you will be liable for very large damages. Or in the extreme case, we'll hang you if you cause an accident. So one of them is punishing what are seen as the inputs to an undesirable outcome, speeding. And the other is punishing the undesirable outcome. And to take exactly the same logic in an entirely different context, think about the question of paying people. What's the standard ex ante employment arrangement which most employees have? What do you pay for? Ford, what Ford wants is automobiles. What does Ford pay its employees for? What determines how much Ford pays you? They're about value. They're paying you for hours, right? They're buying hours or days or weeks. That's an input to producing automobiles. Can you think of people who are paid by output? The obvious example, salesmen who are paid on commission. All right. So it's the same logic. You want, in one case, you want to prevent something, namely auto accidents. In the other case, you want to produce something, namely sales or cars. And one way of doing it is to reward people for the inputs that you expect to produce that thing. Another is to observe what actually gets produced and reward or punish accordingly. So that turns out to be a useful way, again, of thinking across quite a lot of legal and other issues. So we have a chapter on that. Then there's a chapter on game theory, and game theory is a interesting and frustrating subject because nobody's ever really solved it, but they've got pieces of solutions that are interesting and helpful, and we will see what some of those are in a while. And then there's a chapter on the value of life. How much is your life worth? Well, what do the tables show? But what are they measuring? But what are they measuring? Not how do they figure it out? But they are, what is that value purport to be the value of? Is it value which you'll sell your life? Probably not. Yep. Potential income. That's a possible measure. Is that the value of your life? If you're trying to decide how much your life is worth, is an income a fair measure of it? Let's suppose we have two different people, two different futures for you. In one of them, you are a workaholic. You work 14 hours a day at a very unpleasant and difficult and demanding job that makes you very unhappy, and you make $100,000 a year. The other one, you work 8 hours a day, most days, but you take off days when you feel like it, really fun, rewarding work, and you only make $90,000. Which is the more valuable life? To you. If you were choosing between them, which is the more valuable life? Clearly. But that suggests that the value of life, the person after all your life is most valuable to you is you. You're the one who will be really upset if somebody kills you. I mean, you might be a little bit upset, you know, might be happy, you don't know, it's meant to be. That suggests the value to you of life. It doesn't make any sense to think of it merely in terms of potential income. You ought to think about the cost of getting that income. Right? Just as the value of the company isn't its revenue, it's its profit. You'd like something analogous to profit if you were thinking in your terms about Alright, in any case, let me see if I can show you what strikes me as the initial paradox that we will attempt to resolve and deal with the value of life. Suppose the way the general economic approach to measuring value that we call revealed preference. We offer you a dollar for an apple. If you sell the apple, that shows that it was worth less than a dollar. If you refuse, it shows it's worth more. So we imagine somebody comes up to you and he says, you know, I've got a serious heart problem. I need a heart transplant. I'd like yours tomorrow. What's the price? What kind of answer do you think most people would give? There is no price, or maybe a few people for whom there's some very valuable, something they really want money for, enough they're willing to die for, maybe there are two people with it. Pretty close to infinity, right? That's the gut feeling of it. Suppose we ask a different question. Suppose we say, you could, by spending an extra $1,000 on getting your car checked more often, reduce by 1 in 10,000 the chance that you will die in an auto accident. Well, if your life is infinitely valuable, then reducing the chance of losing it by 1 in 10,000 ought to be worth a huge fortune. Do you think, in fact, that most people would pay $1,000 to make their car one part in 10,000 in that sense safer? No. So you could imagine one measure of your value of life, and one which we can actually, to some extent, evaluate by looking at people's behavior, is what people are willing to pay to be a little safer, what they have to be paid to take more dangerous jobs, things of that sort. And a different measure is at what price they would agree to give their heart today or tomorrow. And the question is, why are those numbers so very different, which they are? I will let you think about that, but that chapter is really partly about the resolution to that puzzle. Here's a very simple answer, it turns out, to that puzzle, and then we can go on from there. All right, so that's the list of stuff, which is the economics, of which probably the most important part is the chapters on externalities and dealing with externalities, because a lot of law has to do with that, but all of the parts, I think, are important. We didn't have a midterm. We didn't have the second half of the course, which starts out with a chapter on property law, which starts really with the question of why some things are property and some are not. That to the non-economist, the puzzle is why anything should be private property. Because after all, why bother with all this greedy stuff about saying it's mine? Wouldn't it just be better for anybody who needs something to use it? And economists have an answer to that question. But then that answer raises a second problem, because after the economist has finished showing that private property is this brilliant solution to half the problems of the world, just a wonderful solution, then the question is, why isn't everything private property? For example, my favorite example, the English language. You could certainly imagine a legal regime in which English language is intellectual property. Every word, at least every word that had come into existence recently enough so we could know where it came from, was the intellectual property of whoever first brought that word into existence. And in order to speak a sentence, you had to first license the words in the sentence from the owners. And one can, I will, offer arguments for why there would be some advantages to that system, but it strikes me it would be a very quiet world. It would be very hard to make that work. So then the question is, why does it make sense that some things are property and some things are commons? Right? Commons mean anybody can use it once. And part of that, there's some other stuff in the property chapter as well, in particular, given that you have property and land, what does it consist of? What rights with regard to the land belong together? But if we just take the property versus commons issue, that, I think, is very interesting for the next chapter, which is intellectual property. Because, of course, most intellectual property is a commons. That if you want to build a supermarket, you do not have to pay licensing fees to whoever first thought of a supermarket. If I want to use Posner's ideas in my book, I don't have to get his permission to license those ideas. And if other people want to use my ideas, they don't need my permission. But there are particular forms of idea-like stuff, which are copyrightable or patentable, and It turns out, if you look at it, that copyright law and patent law come from the same sentence in the U.S. Constitution, and yet they're quite different legal systems, as many of you probably know if you've studied intellectual property, and so the puzzle becomes why they are so different. And what I will argue in that chapter is that the arguments for making something property instead of commons are much stronger for copyright than for patent. That copyright has more of the features that make property a sensible arrangement, fewer of the features that make commons a sensible arrangement, and that is a possible explanation of why we give copyright not only to anybody who asks for it, but even anybody who doesn't ask for it, whereas patent requires an elaborate application, and you've got to persuade the PTO that you've met all their that you've checked all their boxes and met all their requirements, and then practically as soon as you get it, it expires. Unlike copyright, which as we all know, anytime the Mickey Mouse is about to go out of copyright, Congress extends copyright. Slight exaggeration. So that's an attempt to use the economics first to think about ordinary property and then to think about intellectual property. We then have a similar pair of chapters, of which the first one is on contract law. And what do you think is the specific area of law that, having figured out contract law, we would then naturally want to apply those ideas? What is the most important contract that about half of you will ever enter into? Very good. That's the biggie. And so the chapter after contract is family law. Because little family law isn't entirely about contract, one way of thinking about it is to say, here you have this immensely important long-term contract. Why does it have the features it has? Why has it become shorter term over the last century? Why has it become more easily dissolved? What are the terms on which you dissolve? And a whole bunch of things which, to the cold-blooded economist, look like issues ultimately in the economics of contract, not in the mushy stuff we call romance. After that, we go on to tort law. And the thing that naturally follows tort law is criminal law. Because if you hadn't gone to law school and had thought about these things from the perspective of a man from Mars, you would see tort law and criminal law as two ways of doing the same thing. That someone does something bad, the legal system intervenes, something bad happens to him, so you won't do bad things. And as I like to say, this was a point that was made particularly obvious some years back when O.J. Simpson was first acquitted of the crime of killing his wife and then convicted of the tort of killing his wife. Now, they know, both of them may have incorrect verdicts, but of course we have different standards of proof in tort law and criminal law. But the question is, why should we have two different ways of doing it? But anyway, that's actually two chapters later, but tort law and criminal law are things which I think naturally go together as systems in which you impose costs on people in some sense to deter them from doing certain things. So we discuss tort law, we discuss criminal law, and of course the first puzzle in criminal law is what's wrong with crime anyway. After all, when a pickpocket takes $100 from your pocket, you're $100 worse off, he's $100 better off. What's wrong? You may not like it. He thinks it's great. Why should a neutral party regard what he did as wrong? And I think we have answers to that question, too, which makes it interesting. We then go on from that to antitrust. Antitrust is one of the things that people at the beginning of law and econ were very concerned with, and indeed economics says a good deal about it. It is not, I would say, the central concern of law and econ. It hasn't been for a long time. It's one of the things it's applied to. But as hopefully I've already convinced you of, economic analysis of law is really about all law, not just about what other people think of as economic parts of law. All right, after that, I've got some extra stuff that doesn't fit into categories very well, but I think it's worth doing. And that consists really of three parts. The first is a chapter on some very different systems of legal rules. If any of you are around next year, I may well be teaching my seminar on legal systems very different from ours. I don't think I agreed in that seminar when I wrote this book, so I don't have all of the same ones in it. But the basic idea is to look at legal systems that are not modern U.S. law or any of its close cousins. That from my standpoint, the standard modern comparative law class is really a class on variants of the same legal system. American law, modern European law, modern Japanese law. Whereas it's more interesting to look at the legal system of 10th century Iceland, which is a legal system in which there was no criminal law as we understand it, and if you killed somebody, his relatives sued you. And if they won their suit, you paid them damages. And if you didn't pay them damages, they went to the court and had you outlawed. And after you were outlawed, you had 2 weeks to leave Iceland, and if you didn't, they could kill you. And I should say anybody defending you was committing a tort. Quite a neat system. It's one of my favorite legal systems from a sort of an analytic theoretical standpoint. It has some other interesting features. Iceland is one of those things that people don't know as much about as they should. Iceland was settled starting about 870 AD. The legal system I'm describing collapsed in the 1260s, so it lasted for something over 300 years. Population was about 70,000 people, and I would guess that there are currently on Amazon perhaps a dozen novels written in that society in English translation. That's a population less than a tenth the population of San Jose. Population of a medium-sized suburb at the moment, and they were writing books that we're still reading 700 years later. So it's quite an interesting place in lots of ways. I recommend the sagas. That's where we get the word saga, by the way. Sagas was the name of what were basically histories and historical novels that were written down in Iceland in the 13th and 14th century and may or may not have been composed as oral literature several hundred years earlier. That's been a long scholarly debate as to whether they were created by the people who wrote them down or created much earlier. Passed down by word of mouth. But anyway, Iceland is one fun society. A different one, which we'll also look at, is 18th century England. And 18th century England, on paper, is a modern legal system, but there are no police and no public prosecutors, except for act. There are public prosecutors for crimes that are really against the king. You know, rob the treasury of them. The king's got a lawyer. But if all you do is to kill somebody, there is no public official with the job of catching you or prosecuting you. So you have essentially a privately prosecuted criminal system, and then part of the intriguing thing about it is how it worked, why people prosecuted. Now that system is interesting in another way. In fact, what first got me into it, are any of you familiar with the term the Bloody Code?
What?
The Bloody Code. It's a term sometimes used to describe roughly 18th century English law. And the reason for that is it was a legal system in which essentially all serious crimes were capital. And that was what first got me interested in it, because there was a sort of a law and econ discussion why it didn't always make sense to impose the most severe punishment you could for everything and just vary how the probability with which you imposed it. And that was an argument that Decker raised as a puzzle a long time ago. And so I thought maybe this is the system that did it. That if they caught you, they hanged you. And if it wasn't too serious, they didn't try as hard to catch you. Turns out it isn't true. It turns out that if you look at the data, that although on paper everything was capital, of people who were charged with capital offenses, it looks as though only a small minority were actually hanged. That some of them were acquitted, of course. Some of them were convicted of a lesser included offense. And at least some of that pretty clearly was what was referred to, or what got referred to later, as pious perjury, meaning that the jury knows perfectly well you're guilty of the terms of a capital offense, but they find you guilty of a lesser offense, so they don't want you to be hanged. And there's at least one case I remember coming across where, if I remember correctly, stealing more than 40 shillings made the offense capital. And somebody stole a collection of things which included more than 40 shillings in money, and was found guilty of stealing property worth 39 shillings. But furthermore, if you were convicted of a capital offense, you might get hanged. You might be offered the alternative of being pardoned if you would agree to be an indentured servant in the New World for 14 years, I think. You might be offered the alternative of being pardoned if you would agree to enlist in the Army or the Navy if there happened to be a war on. And you might be just pardoned and sent home and told not to do it again. And so all of that, to me at least, was an interesting puzzle when I read an article on that a long time ago. And we'll sort of very briefly summarize that in the class, trying to make sense of that whole system. And one sort of neat bit about it was that when I did that article, I had a theory about what was going on with the pardoning.
And many, many years later, I came across a detailed memoir by a famous 18th century Scotsman, actually, James Boswell, who wrote a biography of Samuel Johnson, who was a lawyer. And he describes in detail a case where he tried to get one of his clients pardoned. And the description, to a considerable extent, fits my theory of what was going on. And that was really neat when it happened. Which doesn't happen very often, unfortunately. But if you'd like, if any of you have historical interests, primary sources are really fun. And there are two good primary sources for 18th century Europe that I know. The very best one is Casanova's memoirs. Casanova is a real person. He was a sort of a con man, gambler, literary figure, very bright, very productive, not very responsible kind of guy. The memoirs are not mostly about his love affairs when they come in, too. It's clear that what he really wanted above everything else was status, to be seen as a rich, important, talented person. But in any case, Casanova feuded with Voltaire. He, at various points, met lots of the kings and important people, as well as lots of servants and unimportant people, and he wrote, I think, six volumes of the current translation. That gives you a vivid picture of 18th century Europe. Boswell is not as good. Boswell is really closer to a diary, although it's a diary written with the intent for other people to read it, but again, it's one person's sort of detailed account of his life, mostly in England and Scotland, but he spent some time in Europe. I think there's one point where he stays at the same inn at which Casanova had stayed 10 years before, so I'm not sure they ever met, but there. In fact, the vague feeling that there is sort of this, I think I saw something suggesting that they may have, that there's some line, I think, in Boswell, which it looks as though might have referred to Casanova, maybe the other way around. Anyway, so that's fun if you want to know history. I keep suggesting, you want to know the Icelandic stories, you read the sagas, or medieval Islam, I can point you at a couple of very good sources, which again are primary sources. But it's much more fun than reading historians. Anyway, another digression. So in any case, the third one that we're going to look at is a radically different legal system, which is about 2 hours' drive from here. It's based on a book by Bob Ellickson. The book is called Order Without Law, and the book is about Shasta County, California. And as in my case with 18th century England, Bob Ellickson gets into looking at Shasta County for a reason unrelated to what he finally discovers, really. He gets into looking at it because of something that Coase had written, and it occurred to Ellickson that Shasta County gave an empirical test of what Coase had argued. Because Coase argues in his very famous essay, among many other things, that it doesn't really matter very much whether when a rancher's cattle trespass on a farmer's crop and do damage, whether the rancher is or is not liable. Because if the rancher is liable, it will pay the rancher to fence in his cattle unless that costs more than the damage done. If he isn't liable, it will pay the farmer to pay the rancher to fence in his cattle. So the outcome is the same. And what Ellickson discovered was that Shasta County, by pure accident, is a patchwork of areas where the law goes one way and where it goes the other, what are called open range and closed range, as to whether the farmer is responsible for fencing out cattle or the rancher for fencing them in. And so Ellickson said, aha, we can see whether Coase is right. And it turned out that Coase's prediction was right for a reason unrelated to Coase's argument. And the reason that Coase's prediction was right, by Ellickson's account, is that the law of the state of California does not run in Shasta County insofar as trespassing animals are concerned. And the reason for that is that Shasta County has norms of neighborly behavior, an informal, privately enforced private legal system, in effect, which trump the laws of California. And the reason they trump the laws of California is that one of the very strong norms of neighborly behavior is that neighbors don't sue neighbors. And consequently, it never gets to the courts, and there are rules about how you behave when your cattle trespass. They're the same rules in open range and closed range. So it's quite a fun piece of work, but it's really about norms. If you think about it, we all take it for granted that laws have to be made and enforced by governments. And we all live under lots of laws that are privately created and privately enforced, namely norms of behavior. I read an article, I think, in the last week or so, about enforced property rights in shoveled parking places in Chicago. You have a big snowstorm, and people shovel out their cars, And having shoveled out their cars, they don't really like the idea that as soon as they pull off to go somewhere, someone else is going to go into that space. So they put a chair or something in the space to mark their claim. And they have no legally enforceable claim. On the other hand, if you were so imprudent as to park in that space, you might come back and find that the mirror wasn't on your car anymore. That the local people would see you as having trespassed and would think it legitimate to commit minor vandalism to punish you for that. So that's sort of a neat example. But more generally, the book is really about norms. And that's what we'll be talking about. That's what that chapter is about. In some ways, I think it's maybe one of the most fun chapters. Then there's one more chapter on what I call the tort crime puzzle, which is what I was mentioning a little earlier, the question of why we have two legal systems with different rules to do roughly the same thing, why certain things are treated as torts and certain things as crimes, why the rules are different in the way they are. If there's, maybe they shouldn't be, because I would argue that one could have a legal system like the Icelandic one, in which tort law in effect swallowed criminal law. You could have a legal system like Imperial China, which I didn't know about when I wrote this book, where as far as I can tell, criminal law swallows tort law, where you can't sue people. You can just accuse them of being swindlers to the authorities who do what they want with them. But the general puzzle is, can you make sense of the division between tort law and criminal law? And then the final chapter largely consists of going back to where we started with the Posner thesis. And we've now looked at a whole bunch of law, and the question is it consistent? Does it support? Does it in fact look as though the common law is economically efficient or not? And I would claim that there are many features of the common law that don't fit the Posner thesis, and further, there are many places where once you know what the law is, you can create an argument to show that that's the efficient law, but if the law were something else, you could create the argument against it. So you will see. So I think there's some evidence for the Posner thesis, but far from conclusive. On the other hand, if you think about it as a research agenda, it's been very productive. It's gotten us to ask a lot of interesting questions, which is what we're doing. All right. Any questions before I go on to talk about economics? Yes? No, either. You've got a choice. You can either present it as like a 10 or 15 minute talk to the class, or as like a 3 or 4 or 5 page essay for me, whichever you prefer. And I think probably I'll make the final deadline for those a week after we cover antitrust, on the grounds that after that we're not doing any areas of the law, we're just doing other things, and it's supposed to be ideally within about a week of covering whatever area of the law you're in. All right. And I assume it won't be on a law case in Sagatari, Iceland, so that won't be relevant. Not that there aren't any law cases. There are some wonderful law cases in Sagatari and Iceland, and some beautiful examples of sort of how you game the law and how you trick the opposition by taking advantage of the law, and also the risks of doing so in a system where people are sufficiently unhappy with your gaming the law, they just kill you and then pay damages to your survivors. Alright, so let's talk about economic efficiency. And if you read Posner or stuff related to him, he calls it wealth maximization. But the basic underlying concept, as I said earlier, is some measure of the size of the pie, or some measure of the degree to the degree to which everybody gets what he wants. All right, that's the problem. And it turns out, as I've already said, to be relevant in both as a possible conjecture about why the law is what it is, and as a possible objective for the law is maximizing. And the problem, I think, is a pretty obvious problem. The problem is that any plausible change in legal rules in a complicated society makes some people better off and some people worse off. How do we add them up? And for anybody interested in philosophy, this is the ancient problem of the interpersonal comparability of utility. How do we decide whether a change that makes me happy and you unhappy on net made us happier or less happy? But economists actually have an answer. It's not a very good answer, but it may be the best answer available. And it's due to an economist called Alfred Marshall. And Marshall, I suppose he died in the early 1900s, but he was writing about the 1890s.
And he's really, more than anybody else, the person who put modern economics together. If you read Marshall's Principles of Political Economy, which again was published around 1900, if you really understand that book, you will know more economics than most people who graduate with an undergraduate degree in economics. There'll be some things missing, but some things have been done since then. But it's got the basic guts of it. And Marshall faced the problem, how do we decide what's an improvement? He used the term economic improvement. And his answer goes as follows. You think of, consider any change, and you could ask everybody affected by the change either how much he would pay to get the change or how much he would pay to prevent it. All right? And how much he would pay to get the change is some measure of how much, by his own standards, he values getting the change. How much he would pay to prevent the change is a measure of how much he disvalues the change. Add them up. How much you pay is a positive. How much you would pay to stop it is a negative. If the sum is positive, we call it an economic improvement. So it's, in principle, a pretty simple answer. And it's got lots of things wrong with it. But it has one thing right with it, which is it actually is a fairly clearly stated definition of what we mean by an improvement. And the other thing right with it is, though it doesn't map perfectly to what we really think is an improvement, it's certainly got a relation to it. On the whole, things that lots of people are very much in favor of and a few people are not, a little bit against, are probably good things, and vice versa, versus the other way. Notice that we're not talking about actually asking people, because if you actually ask people values, they usually have no reason to tell you the truth, especially if they think your actions will be affected by what they say. So the way you, in principle, observe this is by actions, not by words. You say, how do we know that you value that apple at least a dollar? Look, you just bought it for a dollar. How would we arrange to get apples to people who value them at least a dollar? By making them available for sale at a dollar. So if you think about the values as reflected in action, we can then talk about what legal rules or what institutions will have the result that changes which in Marshall's sense are an improvement happen, and changes that in Marshall's sense are a worsening don't happen. Notice also that although we're talking in dollars, we're not talking about dollars. So if you take the very simple case, which I think I go through in the chapter, where I've got an apple, let me make it even simpler than the case in the book. I hate apples, so I have an apple that's worth zero to me. You, oddly enough, are the only person in the world who likes apples, and the apple's worth a dollar to you. When I sell you the apple for, say, 50 cents, the number of dollars in the world has not changed. All right? You've got 50 cents less money, I've got 50 cents more. What is the net effect on you? You got an apple worth a dollar, you paid 50 cents. 50 cents in which direction? Positive. You're better off by 50 cents. Not because any extra money in your pocket, less money in your pocket, but because you have something that was worth more than that money. What's the effect on me? Also 50 cents positive in that particular case, because I gave up an apple, but apples are worthless. Nobody with any sense would eat one. Hell of a thing. But now I've got 50 cents with which I can buy something else. So it's not that it's about flows of money. That's one of the mistakes that people accuse economists of making, and that I think economists make less often than other people, that the money is just as when we say you've lost weight, we don't mean that some of those solid objects that were used on your scale to measure you have just disappeared. We mean that what they measured has disappeared. You know, you're lucky you managed to lose weight mostly. Some of us mostly gain it, but that's a different problem. So the dollars are what we measure it, not what we're measuring. And in fact, you could do economics just fine with no money at all. You could do everything in terms of apples or oranges or anything else people value and get more or less the same results. It would just be somewhat clumsier to explain. Can people see the obvious problems with Marshall's definition, the reasons why one might be unhappy with it? If somebody says, by Marshall's definition, this is an improvement, why might you say, yeah, but it's a bad thing? What are some of the reasons? There are a number of different reasons. Number of reasons why economic efficiency is not a perfect fit to most people's idea of good. Yep?
One person's gain is more than another person's loss. One person's still losing. It's improvement, but one person gets only.
But
But if it is a net improvement, why isn't that good? Well, or you then say that we're not going to approve any changes at all, almost every change, at least somebody is going to be worse off. Yeah. Somebody have other arguments? Seems to me there are a good deal stronger arguments than that. Yeah? On the dollar value, and why is that? Why might that be a bad thing?
Well,
well, I'm not sure what that... Could you explain what you mean by that? That is...
I mean, to go back to your example with the 8-hour job.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, you're shooting the 8-hour job.
And that's evidence, and that is evidence that you value that greater leisure at more than 10,000. So that is a monetary value. Right? The very fact that you're willing to give up money in order to get the better job is evidence of a monetary value. Well, let's suppose we fill in a few more details. Suppose it turns out this particular change produced a $100 gain to one person, and a $100 valued gain, not money, but a gain that one person would have paid $100 to get, and another person would only have paid $90 to prevent. And by the way, the guy who got the $100 gain is named Bill Gates. And the person who took the $90 loss, well, he's in that homeless shelter down the road. Might you suspect that a cost that to Bill Gates thought was equivalent to $100 must be very small, because $100 worth very little to Bill Gates, whereas $90 to the homeless person represents an awful lot and therefore must have been really serious. All right. So one problem is that to most of our intuitions, something like happiness or utility or whatever you want to call it, seems as though it doesn't exactly scale with dollars. That for a single person, you might be willing to say, if it's more valuable to me, I'd be willing to pay more for it. But the fact that it's more valuable to me doesn't necessarily mean I'm willing to pay more for it than you are, because putting it differently, dollars might be a different value to us. Right? Does that make sense? So one possible legitimate criticism of this is that it acts as if the dollar measures the same amount of happiness to everybody. And if you think that happiness is more fundamental than dollars, as I think most people do, then that doesn't seem like a sensible way of doing things. That's one problem. Can you think of another entirely different one? Can you think of a case where something
is a problem? I forgot to turn on my recorder. No, I guess I'd turn it on. It says it's on.
Oh, it's on. All right. Can you think of a case where somebody is willing to spend substantial amounts of money for something, but in your opinion, that isn't really evidence that it's a good thing for him? Yep. Yeah, the example I gave in the book is heroin addicts are willing to pay quite a lot for heroin. Now, maybe they're right. I've never used heroin, so I'm not in a good position to judge. But at least a lot of people would suspect that they're making a mistake. A lot of people would say, well, yes, most of the time, a lot of the time, what you're willing to spend is a good measure of value, but there are these weird cases of heroin addicts and men in love and other irrational patterns of behavior where people are willing to bear very large costs for things that we as cool-minded external observers realize are not really good for them. All right? So that would be a second possible objection. Let me give you a third one, which I think I will give in terms of a real story. And it's not exactly a story about martial efficiency, but it's a story about the ambiguity of the concept of value. I have a house in San Jose, a very nice house. It's a little over 100 years old. And I grow fruit trees. I like fruit trees. I've planted lots and lots of fruit trees, of which I suppose 6 or 8 or 9 by now are actually bearing noticeable amounts of fruit. And I would have more fruit if it weren't that a previous owner planted a live oak in what became my property. And that live oak is not a fruit tree, but it's a big tree and it shades the fruit trees. I have not had it cut down. Why have I not had it cut down? Well, because at some gut level, I don't like the idea of killing a big living thing, which a live oak tree is. It feels wrong to me somehow. On the other hand, if a bolt of lightning happened to strike that live oak tree,
and destroy it. And I then had to pay some money to have the remnants cut down and carve it. Boy, would I be happy. I mean, I might finally get some persimmons out of that damn persimmon tree, for one thing. Not to mention doing better out of the plum tree, and there'd be a few other places I could plant trees if I didn't have the shade of that monster. So that's a certain sense in which my behavior seems inconsistent with the model that I'm using to understand the world. That by one definition of value, would I like to have it disappear? Wouldn't it be nice if it disappeared? From another, would I bear costs in order to remove it? No. And but I think you can think of that as standing in for a lot of more profound questions. So that if you imagine that somewhere in one of the forests in California, there is the oldest tree in the world. Doesn't matter if that tree is cut down. Well, it might be that nobody will be made unhappy by that tree being cut down. It might be that in terms not just of dollar value, but of utility value, of happiness, that tree being cut down is irrelevant. Maybe nobody knows it's the oldest tree, or maybe nobody cares. And yet, many people would say somehow, for some bizarre reason we can't explain very well, that oldest tree in the value in the world has a value beyond its usefulness to human beings. All right, and I tend to put that in terms of sort of value in the eye of God, although you wouldn't have to believe in God to have this attitude, so I think most people have it to some degree.